Rare is the person who can say the words, I survived a serial killer. But tonight on Banfield, four very special guests who did just that. They came face to face with some of the most infamous killers in history, and they lived to tell the tale. Shocking details about the attacks, the escapes, and the sacrifices they made to help bring these monsters to justice. The stories you have never heard before on Banfield tonight. Hello and welcome to Banfield. It is pretty rare in this country to be a victim of violent crime. The vast majority of us, thankfully, never will be. And it is much, much more rare still to be stalked, sized up, and selected for attack by a serial killer. Of that small group, those who survive serial killers' attacks, well, it's a minuscule subset, a club that is beyond exclusive. And we have four such people on our program tonight. Ordinary people marked for horrible deaths, but who, through luck or fate or sheer determination, prevailed. And their stories are nothing short of amazing. We're also joined by a man who studies violent crime and violent criminals academically and in police work and the media. Dr. Chris Mohandy co-hosts the series Breaking Homicide on Investigation Discovery. He's also the author of Born Killers and Evil Thoughts, Wicked Deeds. Dr. Mohandy, thank you for being here. And to begin, I'm also honored to welcome Kara Robinson Chamberlain. In 2002, when Kara was just 15, she was kidnapped from the front yard of her best friend's house in Columbia, South Carolina. And this is where I stop telling your story. And Kara, you pick up the story. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, so like you said, 2002, I was 15. I was at my friend's house and we were getting ready to go to the lake. It was summer day. And she called her mom and asked if there was anything that we needed to do before we left. And her mom asked for us to water the flowers. So my friend asked me if I would do that so that she could go and take a shower. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I went outside and started to water the flowers. I was 15, getting ready to drive. I noticed a car drive by on the way out of the neighborhood that, like, wow, I like that car. And a couple of minutes later, it came back into the neighborhood and pulled into the driveway. And a man got out. And my first thoughts were not that this man looked creepy or scary. He just looked pretty normal. He was an average looking white man. He was wearing a button down shirt. He was wearing just a ball cap and some jeans. And he had like a binder in his arm. And he came up to me and he said, I'm out here handing out these pamphlets today. And I was wondering if your parents are home. And I said, well, this is my friend's house. And he said, okay, well, what about her parents? Are her parents home? And I said, no, her mom's not home right now. And he said, okay, well, I'll just give these to you and you can leave them for her. And so during this whole interaction, he stayed like a reasonable distance away from me. He did not enter my personal space. And when he reached in to hand me the pamphlets, he put a gun to the right side of my neck. And he said, don't scream. You're going to come with me or I'll shoot you. And so I did. And
he took you to his apartment that he shared with his wife, who was at Disney World that day. And is it true he kept you in a Rubbermaid container?
He transported me there in a container that he had in the back of his car. While I was there, I pretty much had kind of, he was an apartment. I could move about the apartment, but he was always within kind of an arm's length away from me and he always had a weapon. But there was a time when he called his wife, is what I found out later. He called his wife and he said he had to make a phone call and he did put me back in the container with a gag in my mouth so that he could make that phone call.
He drugged and raped you for 18 hours. While his wife was out of the apartment. But somehow at 15, Kara, you had the wherewithal to take in your surroundings and figure out an escape plan. I don't know for the life of me how you could have done that, but explain to me how you thought this through.
I think for me, I had some sort of intuition within me where I knew that this person meant me harm, and I knew that he was going to harm me in some way, and I wanted to remain as much in control as I was able. And so the way I maintained control is I tried to stay calm, but I also knew, again, let's just call it intuition maybe, I also knew that at some point he had to let his guard down, that he couldn't be vigilant consistently, and that I was going to try to escape. I was going to try to regain control of the situation by escaping my captor.
And he fell asleep, and that's when you made your move. What did you do?
Yeah, it was the next morning. I woke up before him. I was restrained to the bed. I had handcuffs on both of my wrists, and they were attached to the bed, and he was asleep next to me. And so my hands were kind of up like this, and I tried to detach the handcuffs, the clamp that connected them to the bed, with my fingers, and I couldn't. So I had to kind of shimmy them up to my teeth and use my teeth to unscrew the quick link on there. And then I took the handcuffs out. I was able to slide one of my hands out of the handcuffs and then kind of reach down the bed to detach the restraint that was on my right leg. My right leg was also restrained to the bed. And so I was able to detach that and then slid out of bed and found my shorts. I was wearing his t-shirt at the time, and went to the front door, and there was the container. There was like a vacuum. There were things that were in the way, and I knew that he was right on the other side of that door, essentially, and he was asleep. And so I had to move a whole bunch of things and open the door really quickly without waking him up. And I just knew that I was going to open the door and he was going to wake up, and he was going to look out the window that was right beside his bed that looked out on the front door, and he was going to see me running and he was going to shoot me. But I just kept thinking, it doesn't matter. As long as I get out of the apartment, I'm out and someone will find him.
And so you made it out. How quickly did you find someone and get help?
I just ran across the parking lot and I saw a car driving across the parking lot. There were two men in it, and I ran out in front of the car and kind of waved them down and ran around to the driver's side. And I held my wrist up where I had handcuffs dangling from. And I said, I was just kidnapped and I escaped. And I turned around and I said, I came from that apartment. Please remember that apartment. And they said, where do you want to go? And I said, the police department. He said, get in. And they took me to the police department.
It is remarkable that you're telling me this story about you at 15. I mean, I suppose an adult might have thought that through, most probably not, having gone through the ordeal that you did, Kara. Ultimately, the police were dispatched pretty quickly and he fled. He took off, and what, it was 3 days?
3 days.
He was on the run? What happened next?
So the police went into his apartment. They were able to locate his apartment based on some of the information that I gave them. They were able to locate his apartment. They went in and they found some things in his apartment that led them to believe that maybe he was connected to some other crimes that they did not previously know about. And so they started investigating that. And meanwhile, he was on the run, and his sister actually kind of set him up where she was supposed to be meeting him at a Waffle House, I believe, in Florida. And police were there. They were waiting. He saw them and he kind of went through the parking lot and drove out, and they put out stop sticks and busted his tires, and he kind of spun out of control. And they sent in a police canine, and the police canine bit his arm. And at some point, either while the dog bit his arm or after the dog released, he shot himself, and he actually committed suicide there at the scene.
It is a remarkable story, and even maybe more remarkable that you can recount in such detail what had happened. I understand he called his sister while on the run and confessed to, quote, more crimes than he could remember. I want to bring in Dr. Mohanty into the conversation, Kara, because it's astounding to think, Doctor, that this man, Richard Ivanets, was married twice, described by police as charming, described by his second wife as my husband, he's still my husband, and I love him dearly. He earned two good conduct medals in the Navy. Is this the kind of person you, in your profession, would be surprised to end up a serial killer?
Well, not really. I mean, what you have is his impression management. I mean, this is a guy that is good at, you know, being a wolf in sheep's clothing, camouflaging who and what he really is by the way that he presents himself. So, you know, this kind of charm, this superficial ability to gain the trust of others that he would then use to betray one way or another. I mean, basically, he's doing this stuff behind, you know, his wives' backs, you know, which is horrendous, violent behavior to other people. And he used that same, you know, shtick, that same gimmick, that con to gain the trust, you know, of this survivor, this amazing survivor. You know, he had a whole con to get her in a position to where she would let her guard down or allow him to get close enough to where he would be able to produce the gun. So, you know, this is one of the methods used by the more sophisticated serial murder offenders that have that kind of verbal skill, that are able to fit in, that are the chameleons, and many of them are chameleon-like. That is a characteristic of people who are psychopathic in nature, that they can disarm, that they can find vulnerability, that they can use their words to manipulate. And then once in that position, you know, turn the tables and change so that you see who they really are.
So it's so strategic. I mean, really just so strategic. You know,
the statistics. It's a great word, Ashley. Very strategic.
Yeah, 5 years. Police were looking for him for 5 years, chasing 12,000 tips. He'd murdered three girls. How many others he may have attempted to murder or maybe gotten close but didn't. And then, Kara, you were the linchpin. You were the person that brought that horror to an end. And then, young lady, you became a police officer. I mean, was that the reason? Had you thought about law enforcement? And tell me a little bit about that decision.
It wasn't the reason in the stereotypical, like, oh, because of this, I'm going to go be a police officer manner. But I was treated by law enforcement in such a way that I was given a summer job. And I worked there all through high school and through college. And it really became a family for me, more or less grew up there. And so the sheriff of the agency that I went on to work for, Richland County, he more or less treated me like his daughter. And when it came time for me to graduate, he said, yeah, there he is. He said, you know, you'll always have a job here if you want to have a job here. And he said, maybe you should try being a school resource officer. And I gave it a shot. And as it turned out, I loved it. I went on to investigate sexual assaults and child abuse cases. And then I went on to be a victim's advocate also.
Kara, you're remarkable. And two things. I want to thank you for your extraordinary valor and bravery and for helping to save other people from that killer. And then thank you for sharing your story as well. I'm amazed you have such wherewithal and that you can recount details the way you do. I think it's really helpful to a lot of people. Thank you.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
And Dr. Mohanty, I want you to stay with us because when we come back, the only known survivor of the Railroad Killer. He rode the rails, stabbing, raping, and beating his victims to death at random stops. No one who lived close to an American rail line was safe from the infamous railroad killer in the 1990s. So the fact that Holly Dunn is alive today is really nothing short of a miracle. She is the only known survivor of Angel Maturino Resendez, a drifter from Mexico who showed no mercy to at least 15 victims that we know of. Holly Dunn, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This is one of those stories where it is lucky that we can speak to you. I wish we were speaking under different circumstances, but take me back to the moment that you and your boyfriend were walking along the railroad tracks. You were at the University of Kentucky at Lexington in college, and all of a sudden you came across this man. Walk me through what happened.
So we were walking. It was such a normal night, and we came to this party that was only really close to campus, and it was just a normal college night. It was just such a great time with my boyfriend. I was really excited to just be with him and to spend time with him. We took a walk by the railroad tracks. When we got up to leave, a man approached us, and he had a weapon on Chris. I didn't realize he had a weapon on Chris. He asked us for money. We didn't have any. We were poor college kids. We offered him our car, our credit cards, our ATM cards. He just kept saying no to all of our offers. We then he tied up Chris's arms behind his back with his backpack. He took off my belt and tied up my arms with my belt. When he came over to me to get my belt, I noticed that he had this weapon on us. It was some sort of sharp object, like an ice pick. And so the weapon sort of changed how we reacted. We thought, we need to do what this man wants. He's going to hurt us. So he ended up taking us over to the side grass. He tied up our arms and our legs. He gagged us. But when he gagged us, I actually stuck out my tongue, so the gag didn't work, and I could still talk to Chris. And so I tried at times to talk to Chris, to ask him if I could do anything, if we could get away, if we could run, but it was all of our efforts. Nothing worked.
And he ultimately took a rock and bludgeoned your boyfriend, Chris Meyer, to death, and then turned his sights on you. And how long did the attack last, and what did he do?
I'm actually not sure how long the attack happened, how long he spent with me before the 911 call was made. But he came over to me. He climbed on top of me after he hit Chris. I realized then he was going to rape me, so I tried to fight him. I tried to hit and scream and do what I could to try to fight him, but I didn't know how to fight. I didn't know how I could do anything. So he stabbed me in my neck with that ice pick, and he said, "Look how easily I could kill you." I stopped, and he raped me. I remember floating above my body, not feeling anything. I didn't feel the stab in my neck. I wasn't feeling anything. I was just talking to him, trying to have him put a face with my name. I was telling him a fake name. I was telling him about my fake family, that they would want to see me again, that I would help him, that I would do anything I could for him. I was trying to get on his side so that he wouldn't kill me like he had Chris.
And you said a 911 call was made. Who made the call, and how did you survive this?
Well, I don't remember being hit. I was hit maybe 5 or 6 times in my face and 5 or 6 times in the back of my head. I think he knocked me out and thought he had killed me. But I ended up getting up and walking about 200 yards to a house nearby. And the person in that house, they had the TV on. I walked into their house without ringing a doorbell or knocking on the door. I just walked straight in. And I said, "Call 911. And he did. And it was a college student just like me. And he called 911 for us. And the authorities were alerted. And an ambulance came and picked me up. And I was rushed to the hospital.
So likely, Resendez left you for dead and did not realize that you had the strength and wherewithal to go and get help. Ultimately, that murderer, that killer, admitted to murdering 9 people, but was later connected to 15 murders. And he was found guilty of one of them. and executed by lethal injection in 2006. Does that change anything for you, Holly? Does the execution of a monster like this give you any kind of justice or closure or any of those other words that I would assume feel a little hollow?
It does. It made me feel good to know that that I could testify against him, that I could be a strong person and stand up on that stand and say, you did this to me. And then it was the feeling that I had when he was executed was just that there was always this feeling that he could somehow get out and come and get me, that I was the one that he would want to come and get because I was the only one left. So that feeling went away. And it was just a feeling of relief when I knew that he wasn't in the world anymore and he wasn't going to hurt anyone else.
Yeah, when you found out that the person who had done this to you actually was a serial killer, did it make any difference? I mean, you'd suffered such a horrendous attack. Did it make a difference when you realized who he was?
I think it made it a little more difficult. It was hard to know that there were others that had been hurt by this man, that there were family members missing their loved ones, that there were just so many other people. But it gave me strength too. It gave me strength to want to live my life to the fullest for everyone of Resendez's victims, not just for myself. I want to do it for everyone.
So I want to bring in Dr. Mohandy to this conversation as well, if I can, Holly. And Dr. Resendez babbled on and said things like he was on a divine mission to rid the world of sinners, and yet there he was exacting the worst of the worst on innocent victims. Does that fit any kind of profile, somebody, or is that just plain and simple crazy?
I would never call what he did crazy. He was purposeful, goal-oriented, and definitely had diabolical evil intent. His comments to Holly, you know, as he held that ice pick to her throat, saying that he could take her life, you know, is basically him embracing the joy of having power over life and death, the omnipotent power to control another person's, you know, life, that their life is virtually in his hands. That's what got him off. That's what he lived for. Him offering that he was on some sort of divine mission. You know, I know about that as well, because he sent me a letter at some point and he put a little halo over the eye in his last name, you know, as he rambled on about, you know, the things that he had done and bragging and so forth. But make no mistake, this is just another psychopath offering up a justification, and his interactions with Holly and Chris tell you everything you need to know. This is a man who enjoyed taking life and relished that power over life and death. He was not crazy. He knew what he was doing, and he was held criminally responsible and got what he deserved.
Yeah, there is crazy and there's crazy like a fox as well.
Exactly.
You know, Holly, God bless you for A, surviving, and B, being so strong, testifying against him and ending that reign of terror, and also for sharing, you know, what happened, because this is hard. It's very difficult. And I think for so many people, they could never imagine and never will figure out what it's like to have walked in your shoes. So look at you, successful, you graduated. Are you doing okay?
I am. I'm doing great. I have two small boys, a wonderful family. I have an amazing support system, and I'm thankful for every day.
And we're thankful for you, especially that you're with us. So Holly Dunn, again, my great thanks to you. Straight ahead, Ted Bundy is one of the most infamous serial killers in history. He confessed to killing at least 30 women and young girls, but Kathy Kleiner was not one of them. No, she survived Ted Bundy, and she was able to testify at the trial that sent him to the electric chair. She joins me next. Ted Bundy, the name is synonymous with evil. Before he was sent to the electric chair in 1989, he'd admitted to killing as many as 30 women and girls. But the experts believe he may have killed as many as 100. A handful, Just a handful of women were attacked and beaten by Bundy, but managed to survive. And I am joined by one of them tonight, Kathy Kleiner. Kathy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us tonight. Your story began in your sorority house where you were asleep in your bed. Can you take me to what you remember of the night you were attacked by Ted Bundy?
It was on the 15th of January, 1978. I was a sophomore at Florida State University, and I lived in the Chi Omega sorority house. The house was beautiful. It was a big Victorian house, and our bedrooms for the girls were all up on the second floor. My room faced the back of the house, which overlooked the patio and the drive parking lot. I went out that Saturday and came in to go to study at the Chi Omega house. Went up to my room. It was about 8 o'clock, and I decided to get all my books and sit on my bed and do what I had to do, which was study for a calculus test on Monday. I was comfortable in bed, and around 12:30, I decided to go to bed, to go to sleep. So I turned off the lights and rolled over and laid down and went to sleep. The next thing I remember, I heard a big noise in my room. I heard the door open, and it crashed against the wall as it opened, and it swooshed against our green shag carpet that we had in our bedroom. I also heard a big thud, which really woke me up. Between our twin beds, my roommate and I had a small trunk, a little footlocker, on which we had books and flower pot and some other items. What happened was this person had come into our room, not seeing the trunk because it was dark, tripped over the trunk. I'm waking up now, and I'm looking, and I see the silhouette of someone standing next to my bed. It was dark, and all I could see was the knit cap he was wearing, the knit cap, and a face that I really couldn't see. I didn't have my eyes and my glasses on. In our bedroom, we had double windows that faced over the parking lot. Our windows were always open because we hung plants on the curtain rods. So that night, this person came in, and with a big log that he had picked up from outside the back door, the way he entered the sorority house, he picked up the log and forced it and hit me on the face so hard that he shattered my jaw three places. I about bit my tongue off, clear through to the other side of my face, and bit the cheek there. At first, the thud did not hurt. It was just like a pressure, a heavy pressure. And I don't remember much after that until my roommate started making noise. This person then walked a couple feet over to her bed, attacked her, turned around, and I was moaning now, making as loud of a noise as I could, but I was only gurgling because of all the blood in my mouth. And now I hurt. My face hurts so bad with pins and needles and knives. This person came back next to me, raised his arm again to slam me in the face, and he was carrying that log that just hurt so bad. A car came home that night through the parking lot. Because our window shades were open with the curtain rods, the light shone into our bedroom, and it was so bright. I scrunched my eyes. I was curled up in a little ball waiting for him to attack me again. And the light shone up, and I could see this person become agitated. He like walked back and forth, and he got spooked. So he left our room, ran out the door, and out of the sorority house.
It is a miraculous series of events that you survived, but for that car that startled him, the lights through the window. He had killed two other of your sorority sisters in that house. He attempted to kill you and your roommate. And when he fled about 8 blocks away. And as I understand it, he broke into another college student's room, severely injuring her as well. Have you ever had any connection to the other victims or family members of his reign of terror that night or any other night?
We, in the beginning of the recuperation, it was such a traumatic and just confusing time. I was taken back to Miami. So I left Tallahassee and I left the women that were my sorority sisters. So I never got back in touch with them. But the night when I was carried out of the sorority house, I remember the police came to my bed. The first thing I remember were the police there. And as scared and cold and confused as I was, I knew that the police officer was going to take care of me. And I knew this person was not going to come and hit me again. It was a scary time. I was taken on a gurney down the front stairs, this beautiful wooden staircase at the front of the foyer. And I was taken out of the sorority house on the gurney. And it was so cold and I was freezing and it was misty out and it was about 3:30 in the morning. I was carried out toward the ambulance and there were fire trucks with their lights and the police car with their lights and the ambulance. And I thought for a moment that I was in a carnival. This light and noise just gave me a peace. I didn't know where I was, but in my mind, I was at a carnival, somewhere that was good and happy for me to be there. I was taken into the ambulance and taken down to the hospital where I had surgery right away. And they wired my jaw shut and other injuries I had. And I never have contacted the other members, the other victims' houses, their families. And I felt that to do so, I would have gone to them and said, I survived Ted Bundy. And I want to, you know, suggest that I come talk to you. And then in my heart, I knew if I did that, I would be allowing them to feel like their loved one, their girls were killed that day. And I didn't want them to feel the angst of feeling like it was trauma all over again by seeing me and I had survived. My heart feels
he had been in prison prior. He was in jail prior to the attack on you and your sisters, your sorority sisters and the others that night. And he escaped and then was able, you know, to break into the sorority house because of a malfunctioning lock. But ultimately, after that attack and the killings, he was locked up. He was executed. But before that, women would write to him. And there was a celebrity fandom around Ted Bundy. And you might even argue even to this day, there is a lore. And I wonder how many people think of you or your fellow victims and what you're going through when you see evidence of that fandom.
It is confusing to me. Having been a victim of his, I knew the side of evil and what he was capable of. And he really showed a different side of himself. He manipulated people so much that they believed what they saw and that he was a good guy. And books have been written about him, which I've read. And I wanted to know the side of him that was human. And I did learn a lot. And the women who surrounded him and the people that thought he was so wonderful, I think the women had a complex, or I think they thought they could fix him. And if they were able to talk to him and have them with them, that they could fix him from the sickness that he had. And also, they were probably missing a lot in their lives, and they thought that this would help fill a gap that they were feeling at that time.
I want to bring Dr. Mahandi into this part of the conversation. Maybe you have more skill in trying to navigate the, I would say, psychosis of any women who wanted to be connected to such a beast in prison. Some marry serial killers behind bars, and many killers have pen pals and girlfriends and get married behind bars. And I get it. There is a strange celebrity to it. But ultimately, what else is it about the serial killers who become part of the zeitgeist and who become part of the book and movie and television industry? Why is it? Is it that they have gone so far from the flock? They have strayed so far from the flock, the rest of us can't figure it out?
Well, I think... you know, your original comment was that any person or woman that would get involved or want to be in a relationship with such a person, you know, would be psychotic. I think that's what we want to think, is that there's something really wrong with them. And I would agree. I would not say it's psychosis. I would say it's extreme character flaws, some of which, you know, Kathy talked about in terms of maybe thinking they could fix them. But more often, there is this really pathological, you know, association or identification with the anti-hero that they represent, the person who has, you know, chosen to violate, you know, the world and its rules in such a pathological fashion, and all the power, you know, and dominance that's associated with that, the narcissism. And there is, you know, a need for a person that would affiliate or look up to that, for them to try to associate themselves as a way of bringing themselves up in that dysfunctional way. So it's a character flaw, a very deep and profound one. I've talked to some people that have become fixated on these kinds of people, and you know, they tend to be very dysfunctional, and they tend to, yeah, you know, identify with that power and control that the killer, you know, himself sought. And yet, at the same time, they're able to associate with it, but he's locked up and he's contained. So there's this, yeah, I got it. I got him. I'm talking to this person.
There's
all that,
yeah,
that sick, you know, that sick admiration that they're seeking, but they're doing it, you know, it's a virtual relationship. Even before there was social media, people were having these virtual relationships with these psychopaths. And, you know, it's a form of dysfunctional power and control on behalf of the person.
Dr. Mahandi,
that out, and a part of the people that look up to that.
Yeah, stay with me, if you will, Dr. Mahandi. In the interim, Kathy Kleiner, thank you so much. It's good that you're with us. I'm glad that you're with us, and I'm happy to talk to you as well. I'm very, very appreciative of you telling your story tonight. And when we come back, this one is also one that defies logic. Bill Carnes asleep in his bed, and the infamous Night Stalker breaks into his house and then shoots him 3 times in the head. And yet Bill Carnes is alive, and he's with me next. Richard Ramirez, also known as the Valley Intruder and maybe better known as the Night Stalker. He terrorized California for more than a year in the 80s. His victims, they ranged in age from 9 years old to 79 years old. He was convicted of 13 murders, 5 attempted murders, and 11 sexual assaults. And one of his victims was Bill Carnes. Bill was shot in the head 3 times during the attack, but Bill survived, and he is with me tonight. Bill, I'm so glad you're with us, and I'm so glad that you survived that horrible night. Do you have much of a memory of what happened when that killer entered your home as you and your girlfriend were asleep in bed?
No, I was completely asleep.
But do you know from her account what happened to you first and then to her?
Yes, indeed, I do.
Can you walk me through effectively what that man did?
Well, he broke into the home through the living room window, I believe it was, and then went into my bedroom and pulled out a gun and proceeded to shoot me multiple times in the head. And then he threw me out of bed onto the floor and took my watch off my arm, my college graduation ring off my finger. Then he went across the hall to Ines' bedroom and proceeded to violate her at gunpoint, of course.
Ultimately, the reports say that he made her pledge allegiance to Satan before he tied her up. And as he was leaving, said, tell the police the Night Stalker was here. Was there something that you and your, well, at least your girlfriend would have noted in the fact that he want to get caught, or was he just enjoying the notoriety of being this serial killer?
I think because it had been dragging out for quite some time that maybe he was getting tired of defying the odds, and maybe deep down inside he's getting tired of it and thought, well, maybe it's time for me to quit this stuff, but I'm not sure.
I mean, thankfully, you and your girlfriend survived his attack that night, but so many did not. He stole things. He stole things from your house. What did he take?
Like, he took jewelry off me and my girlfriend's body, and then he took a handful of electronic devices, like my DVD player and my VCR, and some other minor small electronic devices. And he took clothes, too, which is, I take that back. Then he had where to carry those devices, right? So he puts it in my laundry basket along with my dirty laundry and gets in his car and drives away.
Ramirez was eventually caught and convicted and was sentenced to death. But before he could be executed, Bill, he died of cancer. I wanted to know, as a victim of his reign of terror, was that unsatisfying? Did it prevent you from finding closure?
That was closure for me because because we were so far apart, and I felt, well, he'll never find me up in where I'm at. But my family said, well, Bill, maybe he won't find you, but he's got a lot of people who idolized him and were cult followers, and maybe they'd be after you or something. So I had to
be, Bill, go ahead.
Okay, I had to be kind of tight-lipped about it, because if I would go out into a public venue, people, what happened to you, Bill? And it looked like I got in a train wreck or something like that. And I would say, no, I was this and this and that. And then my mom would say, Bill, remember, you can't talk too loud about that, because there may be other ears listening. So I had to kind of cut
the issue. It's miraculous that you survived three, you know, gunshots to the head, and that your girlfriend survived as well. Thank you for sharing your story with us tonight. It was so appreciated. And the notion about serial killers who burglarize, what is it? What is it about the souvenirs? What does it tell us about the killers? That's next. Dr. Mahanty, why the souvenirs when it comes to serial killers?
Many serial killers take souvenirs as trophies, as a way of memorializing what they did. It has sentimental value for them, like a normal person might have a photograph of a treasured memory. These are these individuals' treasured memories of how they took a life, of how they exacted their revenge on society, of something that they can relive the crimes with that has meaning to them. So it's a symbol of power, control, and dominance.
Dr. Mahanty, thank you for your thoughts, and our thanks to all of our guests tonight as well. And thank you for watching this episode of Banfield.